Stay tuned for The Linden Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with actor, singer, dancer, writer, theater person, Michael Milton. Michael is charming and articulate, and he knows almost everything there is to know about theater, and he talks about it in the way that only a self-deprecating insider can. Michael's story is interesting, and so is he. Hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from
welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are. It is about using everything that is natural to you. It's about honoring the person that you are. Maybe that sounds like an oxymoron. How can we be other than we are? But probably you know that most people are pretending in one or many ways to be something that they're not, or pretending not to be something that they are. Maybe that is even more common. More of us are shy about hiding, embarrassed by, tentative about who we are, and therefore hiding it in one way or another. As a therapist, I have seen over and over again the difficulty that people have in just simply being themselves. The what will they think, or will they like it, or will they reject me, or will I lose? That idea, that recurring theme, so powerful, so potent, and stopping so many people. So The Lynn Show is about saying that unfortunately so many of our childhoods have made it difficult for us to demonstrate all that we are. So many childhoods taught children to be shy about, tentative about, embarrassed about something about them. And so they come into adulthood believing that there is something flawed or wrong or weak or ugly about them. And so how can you be who you really are? How can you let everything that you are shine if you think that some of who you are is tarnished? So the Lin Show, as I said, is about saying that happens, yes, that happens, but it may not be a life sentence. It may be possible to recover, to rediscover those things which you had hidden, or to reevaluate those things which you somehow thought were ugly. Of course, psychotherapy is one of the ways to do that. And so if, as you're listening to my show, you think that perhaps you have hidden something, you are hiding something, you might want to think about going into therapy to rediscover it, to recapture it, to own it, to be able to use it. And if you want to know more about that, I have written a book called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And you can get the book by going up on my website, thelynshow.com, thelynshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. And up there on my website, you can also ask me any questions you have. You just click on the email button. I will be happy to answer any questions or hear any comments. And you can also listen to all of my shows. They're all up there in podcast form. You just have to click on the little microphone. Or you can download it to anything that you can download to. And you can hear the shows, including the one I'm about to air with Michael Milton. Michael Milton is a very remarkable guy. One of the few lucky ones who had, as he says several times in the show, approbation as the only and beloved child of his family. And they had good reason to approbate him because he was charming and clever and talented. He was interesting and entertaining. And as a result, he faced life, his early life especially, with the belief that he could do anything. And so you will hear Michael say that when he saw his first high school performance of The Pirates of Penzance, and he noticed that people like him, kids like him, were up there on the stage, he thought, I can do that. And he did. Michael's story of simply following the path that felt right, simply saying, oh, I like that, I can do that, here, I'll do it, and letting himself is not only instructive, it's inspirational. And so in a second, I'm going to play Michael's interview. I have to say, I'm devastated to say this, that somehow I cut off the tail end of his interview, so it's going to end somewhat abruptly. I warn you about that in front. But the bulk of it is really delightful, and you will hear how I am enjoying it, and I know you will be enjoying it too. So here now is Michael Milton. Okay, so I'm here with Michael Milton in his amazing apartment on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And as always, I'm explaining to Michael, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I know you have made your life with many arts.
Many arts all through my life.
All through your life.
Yes.
If someone asked you today how you would define yourself, you know, if they said to you, I see.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, right.
It's a great question, and it's a great practice time for me right now to figure out what that answer is. For many years, I worked for a friend of yours, Marty Richards. That's actually when I met initially.
That is right.
And Marty Richards is a Broadway, or was a Broadway and movie producer. And I could define myself very easily through that office. I can say, well, I'm an assistant, or I'm an associate producer. I doctor scripts that are sent to our office. I read scripts and write coverage on them. And it was my version of being a doctor or a lawyer or that kind of. I'm a plumber. And since Mr. Richards passed away and the company closed, which it was time for.
Well, wait, I want to stop you.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Yeah. Would you say that during that time you thought of yourself as a theater person?
As opposed to film?
Yes, or both, or?
I don't think of myself as a film person at all.
Okay.
I like movies, I watch a lot of TV to stay current with things, but theater is my love.
Yeah.
I love the process, I love the script. You know, it's just getting into a stage script is entirely different than a film script. I mean, you've got it there on the page. I can visualize it so much easier. I think I'm my most effective when working with another playwright, to help them form their ideas to the best of its possibility. And that is the language that I speak. We did make films. I did work on Chicago. I worked with both Larry Gelbart and Bill Condon in helping them develop their scripts. Ultimately, it was the Bill Condon script that we used for the film. It's such a visual medium. I like words. You know, I want the words to be heard and said. And a lot of the words in a film script are just for the script. You know, they're describing the picture that you're seeing, and then there's two words, which is brilliant. It's just not my medium.
No, so, but wait. So I'm listening to you. I'm hearing not only this passion for theater, but this passion for words in and of themselves. Am I wrong?
No, that's absolutely correct. I mean, yes, that's right. Positive and negative. I can do both. I was a history major in college with a music minor, and my jobs over the years, even though I was an actor early on and a singer, and I'm not a very good dancer, but I did make some money as a dancer. Through that period of time, writing was something that I did. I mean, you know what it's like. You're out on the road, or you do whatever, you journal, you pass the time, you know, and that's what I did.
Excuse me, but everybody doesn't pass the time writing.
Well, you should. Wherever you are, write more.
Yeah, really, really. No, I think that's right. So the question I ask is, I think, going to be a little more difficult for you than for other people, because you have so many passions. So the question I ask is, can you remember the very first time in your life when either words or stories or acting or singing or performance, we're in New York, you can hear, captured you, drew you, people said, oh, you know, you're very clever, that's a very good story, or can you?
Yes, this is like three answers. The first one is remembering the first time. My first experience seeing live theater was a production of the HMS Pinafore at Castro Junior High School. I was in seventh grade. The eighth graders did the show. And it was the first time I kind of got that my peers were doing this thing on stage. I'd seen theater pieces maybe before that, but that was somebody else. Those were actors. These were people that I knew who were up there, and that seemed reachable. It seemed like, God, I could do that.
Yeah.
So that was kind of that light. A few years after that, my folks took me to see Man of La Mancha, which was on tour with Richard Kiley. I think it was probably the first or second national tour of the show up at the Curran Theater in San Francisco. And I didn't necessarily take in the full... I'm still taking in that show. I mean, it's a magnificent show. But I remember at that time being moved by it and now thinking, wow, so these people might have done HMS Pinafore in eighth grade, but now they're really in this incredible performance. But by that time, I could figure it out. I figured out, oh, I can do these steps of that process. I mean, that was about being on stage. That was acting.
Well, wait a second. Hold on. Then I want to follow that.
Okay.
So did you do some steps did you join a drama club? Did you audition for a play?
Oh, right away. I mean, as soon as I figured out that could be me.
Yes.
Yeah. Then I started, I joined the speech and debate club. I wasn't sure what the direction was going to be. I was studying to be, the plan was I was going to join my uncle's law firm when I graduated from college. So that was still 12 years away. But it seemed like speech and debate would be the logical place to start. And this is actually cute. My mom loves this story. I wrote my first speech, and these speeches are supposed to be, you know, more about something I feel, or, you know, and I didn't get that. I thought it was just a continuation of education. And my first speech was, and nobody pre-reads it, you just put it on cards and you get up in the competition, was medieval armor. speech was about. I was, you know, all this studying. It was just like this lecture on armor and people nodding off. So, you know, those steps are important too. You know, you've got to realize you got to engage the audience.
Did you feel bad? I mean, did they?
Thank God I have thick skin. I mean, and from early on, I was an only child. I kind of lived in my own world anyway. I had such, is approbation the right word? What is it when you're totally accepted?
Yeah, I think it is.
Yeah, is it okay?
Right.
I felt that in my family. They kind of let me get away with murder, and, you know, I didn't really judge myself.
No, that's great. So do you remember how it felt to be up there speaking?
Great.
You like it?
Oh, it's never changed. There's always that feeling of nervousness as you go up the stairs or come out onto a stage or do anything. You know, I always have that little, well, it got to be more later on as the investment became bigger.
Yeah, the stakes got higher.
The stakes got higher because I was making my living at it. And then all of a sudden it becomes a little fearsome for a longer period. But then, you know, you get up and as soon as those first words come out, you just feel that even... Thinking about it now, I'm talking about medieval armor, I relaxed and it became a little more showman-y.
You loved it.
Yeah, it was intuitive and I didn't know a lot, but I think if we're really working to our highest degree, we shouldn't know a whole lot. You know, we start pretty fresh every time.
But actually, it's funny, I thought you were going to say something else. I was going to say, I thought you were going to say that if you're working to your strength, which you already had. You had, as a strength, I expect people to want to hear me. I expect to be listened to. And so you could lead with that. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do. I think there is a certain... Fortunately, I don't think everybody has that in their upbringing, a feeling that, darn it, you're going to listen.
Yeah,
but as an only child... And the only child of my family for a long time, my extended family, everybody listened to me, no matter what I said. They were all paying attention and thinking how smart I was, which is, again, that gives you that same sense of approval, you know, and approval leads to, I want more approval, and leads to more approval. And
well, it also leads to the willingness to take risks.
Yes.
Right? You know. And I like to make this point as high lit as I can, the significance of that, of getting that from the family of origin. That is where we learn, essentially, whether it's safe to take these risks or it's not, and you clearly got that.
Well, wouldn't you say, I mean, because of our generational time, our parents, at least our grandparents, had taken risks because they had come from another country. So we already had it was a huge chance to come here. I mean, I think we forget about that these days. Going through Ellis Island and leaving not necessarily a good situation, but you didn't know it really lay ahead. And my parents definitely had that. They took tons of risks. And I don't know. Nobody's talked about it. But in retrospect now, I see that that was the energy. And I think it's just gotten more and more diffused. And I'm not judging it. These television shows about Boy Can I Ever Dance or Singing America or whatever they are have led people, I think, to believe that that's really not the trajectory. I mean, it's not something that you just get to go and do once and then you're a star. Think about the number of people who are wonderful who go onto those shows who we never hear from again. And I wonder what that does to people psychologically with that. I mean, because of our parents, because of our grandparents, I do have a real sense of moving forward, you know.
Right. You continue to work. Get up again.
Yeah. Right. Reinvent.
Yeah, I think that's incredibly important, and I do think there's less of that. But even in that generation, I don't think everybody got it. So I think it's lovely, and you demonstrate really what... how that can impact a child. So 7th grade, you say, wow, I can do that, and then it's speech and debate, and then what?
Then there was an audition for Bye Bye Birdie. And I would have gotten the lead. I'm sorry, if the gentleman who got it is still with us, then I'm sorry, but I would have. And except leads went to seniors, and I was a lower classman. But they gave me the Paul Lynde role, Mr. McAfee, and I can't believe I remembered that name. And at the end of the day, it was the better part for a high school production, because you could just chew scenery until it was a kale salad. And believe me, that's exactly what I did. And it's good and bad, because I'm not really that part. For many years, I was more a leading man kind of role, who don't really get to chew the scenery that way, but I always want to. it's so fun. And I got lots of
approbation.
Approbation. That is the right. I hope we're using the right word. And then that just began that slow. You know, in high school, and I don't know if you've felt this as well, and actually in college too, if your voice can be heard without microphone, in my case, the theater was in the what doubled as the cafeteria, so a big echoey room. If you can be heard, and my voice can be heard pretty much anywhere, that you became kind of a star. And then the district person who did district drama for the summer came, saw the show, and said, hey, that, I mean, it wasn't great talent, it was just people can hear him. So that developed into my first professional job, which was The Fantastics. I got cast in a Santa Clara Valley, which is where I was living at the time, production of The Fantastics, which I ended up doing many, many times, never in New York, but I did lots of productions of that.
Okay, so how old were you?
I'm still in my teens at that point.
Really?
Yeah, I was a senior in high school the first time that
You got cast in a professional?
Production of The Fantastics.
That's pretty amazing.
Well, I guess, you know, I never thought about it at the time because it was localized. It was in Los Gatos, which is in the Santa Clara Valley near where we lived, at a lovely theater, which I worked at a lot. It just seemed natural in that way,
right?
Which is the same way as I went along and I went to college.
Well, wait, no, I want you to tell me the whole story.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No, it's all right. So are you thinking of yourself as an actor there?
No.
You're still thinking you're going to be a lawyer, but isn't this fun?
Exactly. This is a fun thing to do. I can make sense of it to my family, who's sort of sitting there chewing their fingernails, like, we don't want this kid to do this stuff. That the plan is I'm going to be the lawyer. My parents are real estate people. That this is going to be a great kind of synergy in our family. And by the time I'm in college, I'm pretty clear I'm just faking it about law school.
I love law school.
And by the time I get into law school, I really know I'm faking it because, I mean, I dropped out and I didn't tell my parents for a year. They assumed I was still going to law school.
Oh,
and during that period of time, I got my equity card, so at least I had something to say.
Yes, you could say, yes.
I got another profession now.
Right. I'm a professional.
Professional.
Yeah, so it's real interesting because you got this double thing. You got, whatever you do is fine, whatever you do is fine, whatever you do is fine. Oh, don't do that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I didn't think about it that way, but although they've been supportive.
Well,
I'm
sure they were, but it wasn't what they wanted.
No.
I mean, and you knew that. But it's interesting, I mean, maybe this is not accurate, but what seems to me is that they set themselves up in an odd way because they gave you so much permission and they gave you the sense that whatever you wanted to do, you could do.
Mm-hmm.
So when you wanted to do something they didn't want you to do, they were stuck because they'd already given you this sense of entitlement.
Yeah. You know? Well, and they had, and I think very proud too. I mean, you are. When you see, I know I've got a child who's a musician and a singer and an actress. That's not what she's going to pursue. But when I would go to see her on stage, you just feel such pride. And for my mom, it was always that line that I know you as an actress hate to hear, which is, how do you remember all those lines? How do you get your voice out there and not get tired? Which is fine. Those things are impressive on a certain level, but it's not exactly what you want to hear from people.
You want to hear, wow, you're amazing.
You changed my life.
That's right. That's right. You changed my life. That's great. Yes, that is what we want to hear.
Always. I mean, somehow.
Okay, so you went to college, but you didn't major in theater because you were still pretending you were going to go to law school.
Exactly. I did not even want to bring that up. I did tons of shows during that period
of
time.
Did you? Yes.
More productions of The Fantastics, which kind of became
my thing.
And it was popular then. I was in college in the 70s. And The Fantastics came out when? In the early 60s? Mm-hmm. So it had just kind of reached the other coast at this point. And everybody realized, hey, few people, cheap show, a stick for a wall.
Right.
There were a lot of productions of it going on. So if you knew the role of Matt, you got to do it a lot.
So you get into law school. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Right? And where?
Santa Clara.
Okay. Yeah. And then when did you drop out?
First year. I just knew this was not going to work. I mean, I did shows while going to law school. There's no time. You know, there was...
Yeah, no, you can't. These are two very demanding professions. Sorry.
You know, it's funny that you... And I appreciate you're asking me these questions because I think I've always had a bit of guilt. And in this moment, at this time of my life, I'm realizing in my... being in my own corner on this, how brave it was
for me to
have paid for that year of law school. My folks helped out to the extent that they did. I had all the books. I'm committed. I've now committed to this. And even with all of that going on, my urge was strong enough to say, this isn't for me. And I knew it, and I acted on it. I think that's one of the bravest things I've ever done.
I think it is. And also, it's what the Lynn Show is about the ability to be true to who you really are, especially when there's pressure saying you shouldn't be that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you're exactly right. It's brave, and also it's honoring. It's self-honoring. It's saying I can't betray myself. You know, even though, my parents would like it, even though maybe it's the conventional wisdom would say it's a better route, whatever it is, I can't betray myself, which is what I think you did.
You know, one of the big challenges of that, and we said it earlier, or you said it actually earlier, was I was young. I mean, when you're that young, making that big of a decision is cushioned by the fact that you feel like you're going to be around for another 600 years and you got plenty of time. I'll come back to law school if that's the point. I think the trick, at least the trick for me, has been to remember that you've got to imagine that you always have limitless time and to make the choices out of that. Because I think in intervening years in the last decade, I think a lot of my choices have been safer choices because I think, well, how long can I do this? Or how long can I be a long-distance runner? Or how long will I be able to do? And so I start to kind of be a little more careful mm-hmm. with the decisions. And I not all the time. Sometimes I'll make a really brave decision now as well. And those feel the best. At the end of the day, those always feel the best. If I die tomorrow, if I die in another 30 years, what's it going to matter, you know?
I was true to myself.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I do think that that's not a common thing. I think that lots of people are struggling to do things and be things that are not what they really are. And you pay a big price for that, in my view. So we have you. The other thing that occurs to me about for you is that because it happened so organically for you, you saw this and you said, oh, I can do that, and then you did do it. And you did it, and people liked it, and then they wanted more of you, and then you got a bigger thing, and then you were professional as a teenager. So you must have thought in some way, I can do this.
And it wasn't planned. There was no roadmap. My roadmap was Judy Garland, unfortunately, I suppose, although I didn't, smoke or take drugs. But it was like, I just... thought that's kind of, there was a trajectory sort of in my mind that, oh, I'm on it. And for, gosh, a long time, everything just happened. Mm-hmm. It really wasn't until I got to New York. It was my first moment of intimidation.
Well, hold on. I was just going to ask. So you quit law school. Did you study acting? I mean, what did you do?
Still not. No.
So
no, I was still getting jobs. As soon as I stopped law school, I went down to San Diego. I immediately got a job at a dinner theater down there, which I worked for several years, just pumping out. That's where I got my equity card, just show after show after show. You know, you'd every
So you were working.
I was working.
Right.
I did their Starlight Theater, their outside theater during the summer there. It wasn't great defining work. I wasn't working at the Old Globe Theater, but I wasn't a Shakespearean actor. I was a musical theater guy.
Yeah.
I sang and that kind of, and I talked loud, so people in big spaces could hear me. And again, I'm not planning on anything. I just assume this is the way it rolls. I'm an actor, and now I'm doing this, and now I just never stopped working. That was the thing too, was I was making my living as an actor.
Right.
And I didn't think that was enviable. I just thought that's what happens.
Yeah, well, you know now.
Oh, I get it now. I totally get it now.
Yeah, really.
But
it's extraordinary, really.
Yeah.
So, okay, so then what made you come to New York and when did you do that? How old were you?
Well, still not taking acting classes or studying voice or taking dance classes even. I went from San Diego, where I worked for several years. I was cast in a, what sort of words can I use here? A TNA show in Las Vegas.
Right.
Yeah, which is topless girls with lots of feathers, and I was one of the singer-dancer boys in that show for a couple of years. Now I start to take dance classes because I realize there are like better dancers out there in the world. I better start taking dance class. So I started that then, and then from there I got cast on a cruise ship. So for the first time I went to the East Coast. It originated in Miami, and I did that for about 9 months, did a kind of a review show, not kind of, it was a review show called Sea Legs, appropriately, Sea Legs on the ocean with the motion, and did that for 9 months, and now I'm on the East Coast, and I've got friends who are from my Reno days, we're now resettling in New York.
Uh-huh.
And I'm thinking, should I go back to LA or should I go to New York City? I thought, let's give New York a try. That seems like the next logical place
right.
to go.
Okay, and so you're 28, you're 30?
Yeah, I'm probably in my late 20s mm-hmm. at this point. And so I come to New York and now I kind of take on that whole, this is the first time I've stopped working. I stopped working to come to New York.
Yes.
And I think, I came here and I had an audition within the first 2 weeks and I got cast in the production of The Music Man.
Oh my God.
So I went out to, it was a regional theater, so I went to do that. Again, by the way, no acting classes. I have no idea what that Harold Hill was like, but I made it through the summer doing it. And then I came back and settled in New York and thought, okay, I got to get serious now. Took an acting class. I auditioned for Uta Hagen and was in her acting class. I got a voice teacher. And that's when I think the bigness, it shouldn't be thought that way, and I hate to say it that way, but I realized in all of those years of the family support and always hearing yes, for the first time I started to hear no. And for the first time I kind of got out of myself and realized how much I didn't know. How limited I was in my range. I could do a couple of things pretty well, but that was it. And those were ageist kinds of things. I mean, you were
going to outgrow them.
I was pretty much outgrowing. I mean, I looked young for my age, but I wasn't going to squeak out any more Fantastics.
Yeah.
You know, those days were behind me, and it was now an El Gallo, and I'm not ready to do an El Gallo. And I think Uta Hagen's class was a hit-or-miss process for me. My voice lessons were hit-or-miss. I didn't really have a technique, and I wondered, well, I got this far without one.
Without one, right.
But on the other side was this, and you're getting older, and you can't do these dance things so well anymore. And so now into my early 30s, I'm working sporadically. This is the first time I wait tables. So now I pick up a waiting job at a restaurant that lets me go, and I do get cast in regional things. I was in Florida, actually, at a dinner theater in Boca Raton. Jan McCart, she has had a dinner theater there, and I went down and worked for her. Did regional out in Indiana, Cleveland. I had a couple of gigs in Cleveland in the summer. But again, would come back here and went through that period. Did you have this where the more you knew, the more you knew you didn't know,
definitely.
And the more that kind of stopped you?
Yeah, because what you didn't know is getting bigger and bigger.
Yes,
right.
It grows.
Yes.
It doesn't.
It's growing.
It's exponential.
Yes,
it
right.
Just the more I knew,
right.
And I just like, would you stop? Just
yeah, right.
Hold the line.
Right.
Can we catch
exactly
up with
right.
with you for a second.
Right.
And
right.
It never did. It just got bigger. And it was, and again, all through this period of time, I'm writing. Now I really start to write.
Oh, yes.
Because I think that realization made me more empathetic. I wasn't particularly empathetic before because I figured if one chose to be an actor or whatever you chose to be, you had this, like, smooth ride
to
a point. And for the first time, I thought, wait a second. And now I'm going to classes with people who haven't had that experience,
right.
Who are struggling, who...
And have always been struggling.
And have been struggling from the get-go.
Right.
And it was revelatory to me when I figured out... I judged it to begin with. I just sort of thought, because I was afraid of it. You know, it's so... You don't want to think this could happen to me, but it was happening to me. And then I just accepted it and thought, okay, then maybe you don't always get to have this experience. I started to cast my nets differently, wider, still wanting to be in theater and music and somehow, but not so clear. I wasn't so clear what's going to happen next.
Well, actually, I don't think you ever knew what was going to happen.
I never did, but I got used to a certain trajectory.
Yes, right.
No, I wasn't used to it. I was working so periodically, and even in New York, I became, when I was my greatest asset at one point, I became my greatest enemy because I judged myself before anybody else could. And when I thought I would see performance, I had Broadway. That was the other tool that I had. Is before I'd see an occasional road show.
Right.
Now I could go to theater every night of the week, which I went often, and thought, I didn't have that experience anymore of when I was in junior high, thinking,
I could do
the HMS Pinafore. Now I was looking at the greatest actors in the world on stage, and I'm thinking, I don't know if I could do that. I don't know how many acting classes are going to get me into the position where I might be able to do that.
Right.
So I had a crisis of confidence when I came to New York.
Yes.
And it wasn't a bad thing. Ultimately, I think it led to opening up other doors.
Yeah, I want to ask a question. You said, you know, you started to write. Did the writing suddenly occur to you, or had you thought earlier in your life about writing?
I always prided myself, and I was a bright kid, so I it was one of my skills. Communication was one of my skills. I knew I had an ability to write. I didn't dig into it until I was in New York. I wrote, I journaled, I wrote lots of letters. And those were in the days when my handwriting was still pretty good. And then I discovered typing and I was off and running. And computers, even more so. When I got to New York and I had this epiphany that, I know this sounds so trite, but it's so easy to have your head in the clouds when everything is just going your way.
I don't think it's trite, I think it's true.
Okay, and to have that first block and to also feel, I think I was fortunate to also feel sympathetic, and not so much towards myself initially, but towards what other people were going through. That started to inform my writing. I became more self-reflective at that point. And I also had the good fortune of living with the late Jim Hansen, who was a miraculous writer, and he received the New York Council of the Arts grant for playwriting. And so I was aware of words in a certain kind of way around the apartment when I was here. And also I thought when I would read his stuff, I would think,
I could do that.
So I felt back to junior high school again, where I thought, here's somebody that I've known for many years. He and I went to college together. And here he is producing work. And I think, well, maybe there is something. I mean, if it was Christopher Plummer, I can't do that. But it's somebody in my circle.
Right.
They can do what I can do it.
Right.
And fortunately, that was the case. And early on, in this same period of time of self-reflection and digging, you know, Uta Hagen as an acting teacher demanded for a lot of introspection. Of course, you had to get it out of you to bring it to life on stage. But I had the benefit of getting to write it out. And one of my very first pieces, and this, it's funny, it's a mirror for my my acting days was a piece for the New York Times. It was it wasn't an assignment, but I wrote a piece modeled on the About Men column in the New York Times magazine, Sunday magazine, and I just sent it in. And 2 days later, I got a call from one of their editors saying, "We're going to buy your piece." And I guess I knew that was a pretty cool thing. But again, it felt like, oh, good, now I'll just do this with writing. now I'm a writer, and now I'll just like start churning stuff out. And this is kind of but this one happened much faster, this arc, because the New York Times piece was well received, and it was a banner piece to let other gay writers know that the New York Times was now entertaining a gay sensibility. And New York Times is a liberal newspaper, we all know that. That was a big historical moment. This is 1989. And they were shifting. They were going to shift the piece. And this piece was about my experience, true experience, as somebody in school whose friend was we didn't know what we were at that point, but on reflection, and he's still alive, was gay and also highly gay, in not a definitive way. At that point it would be a sissy or whatever the words that were called, but he was theatrical, and so I really liked him.
He was flamboyant.
Flamboyant, there's the word, thank you. And I just loved this guy, and we are friends still, except when I was in high school I also realized that his flamboyance, I was sacrificing a certain kind of popularity that I also liked having by being friends with him. So I shut him out of my life when I realized that was going on, and kept him out of my life for a long time. And when I wrote that piece, we were occasionally in touch, but I had to go back to him and say, "I need for you to read this piece, fact check it, and okay it with the New York Times." And he did, and it healed our relationship, because I was mean. I was really mean. We were close, and I just said no more. I want to be freer than what I think this is limiting me to. I'm not mad at myself for it. It was just, we didn't really have the language. There have been times in my life where I've wondered, what would it have been like if I hadn't become that self-aware? There must be people, what they love to do, they love to do. You know, maybe there were names called, but they didn't care. They did what they wanted to do.
Right.
And I think there are areas in my life where I did, but I think part of the shutdown that happened for me in New York when I got here was based around, and not surprising that I wrote it out, maybe later on, by the ways in which when I was in high school, I pigeonholed myself as to what other people said. You're tall, you're slender, you wear clothes well, you're this person.
Yeah.
And that's the person I became. I really wasn't that person. I was a fat little kid. And I got thin fast. I mean, I just grew tall. It was like overnight, I was different.
You are so good to look at. And I'm
Thank
sure you.
You
were when you were a kid. So, that must feel really good that people wanted to, you know, said, you're an attractive guy. We want to be friends with an attractive guy. That's really hard to turn down, isn't it?
It's very seductive.
Yes, that's exactly the word.
It is a very seductive energy, and I have such respect for actors that I worked with, like Richard Gere, who, I don't know how aware he is about how good-looking he is and has been all of his life or not, but he gives every sense of being totally unaware of that. And Hugh Jackman produces over a great range of material and is totally easy on the eye, and yet he doesn't seem aware. At some level, you've got to be, because you have to look at a People magazine once in a while, and there you are.
Well, all you have to do is look at the people who are looking at you.
Yeah.
Backing up a little bit, so you start to write, and then you have this experience again where life pretty much says, oh, you write? Okay, good. So then what happened?
New York Times came out. I was getting fan mail based upon this, and it is an extraordinary story, and I have gone back to read it, and I think, boy, you were bright to figure out how to, and really, it's extraordinary in that I read lots of About Men columns before I wrote it, and you know, as a writer, you can write into a format.
Yes, you can.
And I had a good ear, And I still have a good ear for other writers. And if you tell me, imitate Hemingway, or imitate, I can do like a send-up of that. I can't extend it into a novel, but I know what you mean. And I can kind of get the Fitzgerald sound.
It's no, I got it, sound. I got it. Yeah. Okay, so.
And so I did this with this story, and it had a brand of a more experienced writer than I really was. And getting all this mail, New York Times actually asks me to write some other things, which I do, but then I get a call from really the leading literary agent in New York City, in America, perhaps, saying, we want to see the rest of your work. I don't have no work! I've got my journals! And I've been doing this. There was an interval of a few months that passed between the New York Times story and when Arlene Donovan at ICM at that point got to me and said, Sam Cohen said, we want to see your stuff and we maybe make movies out of it. This is a very visual piece that you wrote for the New York Times. I am churning out cheap fiction here like mad, like writing this kind of story. And of course, I'm writing a high, so it's coming fairly naturally. And I bring it in, and of course, none of it is, now I'm writing for something. So that arc kind of drops a little bit. They're not really interested in anything except the New York Times story, and they do get some marketing on that in ways out in Los Angeles. A movie was not made, but there was a screenplay made of it, and it was out the LA Times as well. So that's actually how my dad found out I was gay, through the LA Times. Not a good way, by the way. No, don't let that happen that way.
Did you anticipate that?
I never thought about it. My dad is a newspaper reader. But what happened is not the LA Times, we were at that point based in San Diego again, and it was my aunt who read the piece in the LA Times and called my dad and said, you must be so proud of Mike. And my dad said, well, I am, but why? And she said, you should read the LA Times. And so he went and got it and then wrote, he was disappointed that's the way he found out. It wasn't. He was actually pretty good. But it was, in retrospect, it was...
Not nice.
Not nice.
No, definitely no.
I mean, I was holding back out of fear reasons and want to disappoint him reasons. And at the end of the day, that's not a good thing. So never do it that way. I get passed for. I don't sign a contract with anybody, but I do get some other gigs with... I wrote some for House Beautiful. James White Literary Review. I'm still kind of on this roll for a couple of years. Again, based upon, I can just do this. I've already been told I can, so I'll get up to that level. That's actually what got Marty Richards interested in me, was that 89 story in the New York Times. He read, we didn't meet at that point. We met a couple of years later. Because of that piece, he knew. Again, it was enough of a impact on other writers and producers and people who were aware of it, that it was a couple years later that I was at a party at his home. I was working for somebody at Radio City Music Hall at this point, and we went to a party at Marty Richards' home, who was just this phantasm of, producing, that we knew his name. And it was a big table, and somebody said, oh, Marty, did you read this guy's piece in the New York Times? And it was like such a calling card for my first decade, because it had made an impact. And he said, well, yeah, I do it. I love that piece. And then 2 years after that, he called. He had an opening in his office and said, would you like to come and work as a writer for us? We have some stuff that we're working on. So my writing was...
Your ticket.
It kind of, yeah. It was not unlike my arc when I was an actor.
Right.
It may be different, but it did open doors.
Okay. So you're writing now too.
I haven't stopped writing for many years. Now you know Mr. Richards, you knew him. And he was a man of lots and lots of words, and I'm embarrassed even saying that because I've been talking nonstop, it seems like, for hours here. And I never think of myself that way, but I guess I am. And Marty was a big talker and talked a lot, and my responsibility often was to record his words. And we were either working on his story or his ideas about a piece that we were working on or producing. So I was writing and then going back to the office and typing up to translate into legible and understandable notes for Miramax or for other producers that we were working with or for actors, whoever. So that my writing became very focused,
yes,
and narrow in a different way.
Yeah.
We were dealing with fictional material, but I was adopting his point of view.
Right.
I was his advocate,
right,
in my writing. I would often slip in my own point of view if he agreed with it, and mm-hmm, I'd have to run it by him first.
Right. Sadly, this is where I lost the rest of Michael's interview. But luckily, Michael sent me a piece of his writing, and I'm going to play that right now. You might want to turn the volume up a little bit, because the beginning of this is quite soft, and I couldn't get the volume up any louder than I got it. But it's a delightful piece of writing, and you will hear Michael's ingenuity, his creativity, his talent. So here now is Michael Milton reading his piece called My Dream.
Happiness. Not for another place, but this place. Not for another hour, but this hour.
We are always getting ready to live, but never living.
Forever is composed of nows.
Life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans.
Be present in all things and thankful for all things. This day, this hour, this moment.
But for now, let's just talk about last night. About my dream. Or was it? I awaken in a blazing late afternoon. Half-open blinds have imprisoned me in bed. Shadowy chimeras. Jail cell bars running vertically from my past to my future. I look up, and hovering at my bedroom window, a hummingbird. "Are you looking at me?" I ask. The hummingbird's head tilts ever so slightly, as though he can really hear my thoughts. Regardless, a hummingbird is a miracle of magnificently micromanaged motion. And though the window is closed, I hear his wings thrumming as he rapidly displaces hot desert air, a sound like a purring cat. Or, better yet, and less dangerous to the bird, like a tongue roll. How in God's name does my hummingbird manage in the same moment to be so completely aerodynamically occupied and yet so placidly, serenely still? "Hey, what's it like to be you?" I holler out at him. Silently, I wonder, if I could break out of here, would I too choose to be an iridescent hovercraft? Cockeyed, pollen-stained, sweetly and happily bloated from long days of work as nature's Lothario. He's off to the luxuriant crimson of the lascivious hibiscus near the garage. He's off to the rapturously scented, virginally draped African jasmine on the porch. He's off to the widespread, fecund bougainvillea clinging to the wall, pinkly displaying her flower's sex for my hummingbird's part in pollination's lovemaking. "What's it like to be me?" he calls back, as he begins a rapid ascent into the sky, drawn by wind-borne scents of some new and showy harem in the neighbor's garden. I have not a clue.
Isn't that charming? So Michael continues to evolve. He continues to follow the path that belongs to Michael Milton. And as he said, it took courage to be the person that he is. It is only now looking back that he realizes how much courage it took, as he can see how many people were not given the gift of approbation, how many people were not allowed to be who they were not allowed to think, ooh, I can do that, and then to do it. And so Michael has a lifetime of demonstrating that one can pursue oneself. And then, if it works, yippee. And then if it doesn't work, you look into yourself and you pursue what else is there. But it's not that simple for most of us. Most of us come out of childhoods with taboos. No, don't do that. No, don't be that. No, don't say that. No, don't think that. And of course, we take those lessons to heart and then we don't, whatever it is that we were told not to do. So I hope, as always, that listening to Michael, that you hear what it sounds like when someone is him or herself. Ask yourself, are you following your path? Have you thought, I can do that, and then done it? Or have you thought, boy, I bet I could do that, but maybe I'm too tired, or I don't feel like it, or I don't have the skills. You've noticed that Michael never said, I don't have the skills. Are you stopping yourself for any reason? And would you like to stop stopping yourself? As always, I hope you got something from this show that you can use. Something that inspired you, intrigued you, something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing.